needed each other. Not just on a strategic level, but to keep each other in check. Obi-Wan's tactful diplomacy pulling in Anakin's impossible drive, and Anakin's overwhelming everythingness removing a layer of Obi-Wan's measured clinical thinking. If he survived this, perhaps he'd even tell Anakin someday. Though really, it might work better if he didn't. Anakin's ego didn't need any more feeding. And besides, he needed to get out of this first. Obi-Wan tapped into the Force, trying to sense if his lightsaber remained where he'd planted it. But without knowing exactly where he was in relation to that tower, such a search proved fruitless. He resigned himself to the fact that his weapon wouldn't be accessible until the trial actually occurred in the courtyard. Until then, all he could focus on was what he might say to sway those who listened. The local government, the mourning Cadorne Mordian public, the Trade Federation leaders. Most likely the Republic, Palpatine, the Senate, the Jedi, all of the HoloNet, even if it was on an intercepted signal. And quite likely Count Dooku and Newt Gunray. What might convince every single one of those different factions that somehow, somewhere, there was more to this? And in the end, peace was the best solution. That wasn't something he'd discuss with Anakin. He'd just rely on Anakin for the rest of it. But if his former Padawan learned anything from his promotion, or at the very least Geonosis, it'd be to understand that the responsibilities of a Jedi Knight actually involved listening. In the quiet confines of the cell, Obi-Wan found himself doing something as silly as wishing things were different when he needed Anakin most. Obi-Wan let that feeling pass, knowing that any energy put into those thoughts would likely be wasted. He sat on the floor with nothing but himself and four walls, cross-legged and straight-backed, then closed his eyes. His sense of self released, giving in to something much greater than an individual body and mind, all in search of wisdom and a solution to an impossible problem. Chapter 35, Asajj Ventress. The bulk of Zara's architecture was ornate, all intricate curves and immaculate carvings, much like the tower by which they chased Kenobi. All such a waste of resources. A facade to shield the population from the realities of a cruel life. Here, in an industrial district just west of the capital, Ventress felt much more at home. Everything from the streets to the small storage room she'd rented for a handful of credits felt completely functional. Nothing extravagant or excessive. Her surroundings offered her a simple means to get the job done. Which was why she only had one thing in the room. She opened the door and the room's internal sensors detected her as she walked inside. Kitar followed behind her. But once automated illumination filled the space, she turned to find him examining his blaster. "Something wrong with your weapon?" Ventress asked.
"I think so."
He held it out as if targeting within his sights, then checked the alignment on its small scope again.
"I had Kenobi lined up. He must have gotten lucky."
The bravado in his words caused Ventress to laugh, something that clearly stunned the young guard. She admired his confidence, a trait that was likely amplified by the surge of fury and despair he'd felt since the Katasura incident. But of course it was foolish.
"I am certain that a single blaster is no match for a Jedi Knight. If Kenobi was trying, you would have known."
She walked in front of him.
"Had you survived, that is."
Kitar turned, his permanent scowl seemingly even more pronounced.
How would you know? You're just a diplomat.
Oh, is that what you think?
Isn't that why you're here? To observe the Jedi emissary?
He asked, his voice echoing off the simple metal walls that offered a completely opposite take from the exquisite Cadonimoidian governmental complexes they'd spent time in. She paced the room, considering the challenge presented by his questions, not because they were difficult to answer, but because there were so many choices. Ventress weighed the possibilities, how she might get the most out of his naivete. Her goal had been clear ever since Count Dooku ordered her to fly to Cadonimoidia, and with Kenobi about to face trial, exposing the two-faced nature of the Jedi Order and the Republic was well on its way. Dooku's instructions lacked specifics, though, something he often did, and Ventress understood why. This was not just a test of her physical gifts or her force abilities. He wanted to see her strategize, improvise in the face of opportunity. And this was an opportunity. Ventress promised herself she'd make the most of it.
Just a diplomat, she said, stepping away from him.
With her back turned, she listened, gauging his reaction as the next seconds unfolded. With one hand, she drew back her long cloak, and with the other, fingers gripped one metal hilt attached to her belt, the curve of its form against her palm. She unlatched it and stayed steady, holding the weapon in front of her. Or perhaps more. A brilliant crimson glow emerged from the hilt, the distinct explosive discharge and ensuing hum now filling the room. Do you see? Behind her, a quick shuffling noise told her that Kitar did not expect that, and now he even held his blaster up. He really was obedient after all. When she'd told him to stand guard outside Kenobi's room during her search, she figured he must have taken a peek. But no, he must have stayed in the hall the whole time, completely missing her lightsaber slash on the secure equipment case. She allowed herself a quick short grin before returning to neutral and facing him.
I understand the ways of the Jedi. And I come prepared to defend myself. They are volatile, unpredictable, stealthy.
She took two more steps toward Kitar, the blade close enough to reflect off his pistol's metal body.
Untrustworthy. You have their weapon.
That is one way to look at it.
But you have a pistol. How many people in the Republic have a pistol? How many people in the Outer Rim, in wild space, have a pistol? A weapon is a weapon, regardless of training or skills. Take a closer look.
She angled the red blade his way, the tip of it now close enough that he winced at the heat burning off it.
Ask yourself, have I broken your trust in any way? You saw the datapad. You saw the comlink. You heard the transmission from Kenobi's partner confirming the evidence. This was all here waiting for you. I've lifted the veil for you to see, haven't I?
In a gradual, slow gesture, Kitar lowered his pistol, though it remained in his hand. In return, Ventress deactivated her lightsaber, its deep red no longer tinting the space.
Now I want you to think about your partner. Roog?
Kitar asked, a puzzled look on his face.
What about her?
Do you trust her?
Of course I trust her,
he said.
His gaze fell to the floor, a head shake that showed this struck a nerve. Count Dooku often spoke of the importance of opportunity, of knowing when to force a moment out of nothing, then take it before it slipped away. Now was one of those opportunities. Rugs looked after me ever since I joined up.
Interesting, Ventress said, her head cocked at an angle.
Since you joined, I can understand that. But what about since Kenobi arrived? Any behavior that might seem out of character?
Kitar slowly turned his head to Ventress, the room's harsh flickering light tilting the shadows cast by his helmet over his cheeks.
She's tried to keep you away from me, hasn't she?
She, Kitar started, knew I'd been exhausted. She was just encouraging me to take care of myself. Because Cato Neimoidia needs us.
Even as he said the excuse, Kitar's tone gave away that he was reconsidering it all.
Ventress had him.
The Jedi, she said, are known to be able to influence the emotions, even thoughts of others. Has Roog acted differently since Kenobi has been here? She is a decorated commando, with elite training and a custom weapon, and yet, what happened when Kenobi ran?
Kitar's mouth opened, and over the buzz of the room's lighting, she heard a low guttural sound as he tried to form words. Ventress waited, more than happy to let him come to the conclusion himself.
She missed, he finally said.
Loyalty, Ventress said in a slow, controlled cadence, can be exploited.
Kitar took a single step back, a reaction out of impulse rather than decision. And now Ventress would move in for the finishing blow.
If you trust her, then you will do whatever it takes to break the hold that Kenobi has over her. To break the hold that the Jedi and the Republic have over Neimoidians. You can do this, Kitar. You can be the one.
Just as he had fallen back, she moved forward, keeping a very specific distance to stay in his space, in his line of sight.
How do you think Kenobi's trial will go? The evidence is damning, he said softly. Damning. That is different from certainty, isn't it?
At this point, Kitar might have agreed with anything Ventress said, but her words continued their assault, chipping away at his thoughts and concerns until she led him like a youngling following a toy.
The Jedi are powerful. Their ability to sway minds is unfathomable to those that don't understand their kind. Think of their order, indoctrinating children fresh out of the womb, and their parents. They simply let them leave. Forever. Think of what Newt Gunray said about his encounter on Naboo, the frightening speed and power. And now they suddenly transition from peacekeeper, she said with a derision, to soldiers commanding the military? Is that not concerning to you?
It is.
Kitar's voice came out as a mere whisper. Ventress sensed it, not just from the emotion rippling off him, but from the way his entire body tensed, the way his lip curled, the way his eyes stayed shut as the questions pierced through him. He was on the edge of giving in to her, something that happened so easily that she almost laughed at it. Count Dooku wanted to test her, and yet this was no challenge at all. Cat Asura had created a creature seeking faith in something, regardless of what it was. All she had to do was be there for him.
You care about your people, your planet, the Trade Federation. Then what risks are you willing to take to ensure their safety? To make a statement that will forever sway them away from the Republic? With Kitar's eyes still closed, she walked over to the case of explosive materials and put her hand on the biometric reader. Or perhaps more than a statement. It beeped and whirred, locking mechanisms undoing before she lifted the case open. Stacks of a pliable and very volatile orange compound just waiting to be wired into a detonator. You must calculate the risks, Ventress said, and then make a choice. Kitar opened his eyes, and Ventress stared right back at him.
Chapter 36. Anakin Skywalker. The last time Anakin traveled in disguise was before he and Padme were married. They dressed in simple refugee clothes, a poncho over a patterned vest for him, and an outfit light years apart from her usual regalia for her. The intention of those days was to hide, but what they found became something greater, an overwhelming yearning that consumed both of them. It seemed a lifetime ago, though it had been far more recent. And while he now cringed at some of the things he'd said during those idyllic moments, the way words had tumbled out of his mouth without proper social graces or any sensible filter, he wouldn't trade any of it. Because for all the awkward exchanges and regrettable attempts at impressing her, each of his mistakes, and hers, chipped away at their mutual defenses until they saw each other for who they were. And it all started with a simple poncho, much like the one he wore now. Except this time, his outfit wasn't selected from various materials made available to a Jedi and a senator. Quite the opposite, in fact. With the worn coverings they'd procured along with the Noriker, Anakin and Mill played the role of down-on-their-luck merchants hoping to sell wares on Cato Neimoidia, a planet known for welcoming every opportunity for even the poorest merchant. They left the public landing platform on the edge of Zara, and their clothes may as well have been dirty wash rags compared with some of the others coming and going in the port. Lush robes, glittering jewels, tailored, form-fitting suits. All of it spoke of an expensive class of travelers, who partook in higher levels of business typical of the Trade Federation, where the systemic levers behind merchants and laborers were pushed and pulled for the right price. Those people looked down on, even ignored the ones who got their hands dirty building the merchandise or packing the minerals or selling the wares, which made it the perfect disguise for two Jedi in search of another Jedi.
There are a lot of guards, Mills said as she glanced around.
Anakin must have become desensitized to the Trade Federation's mechanical armada by now, because even though the port's guard station saw clusters of battle droids, their presence failed to intimidate him. Instead, the sight of them provoked an instinct to whip out his lightsaber and slice through them. But he tempered his impulses and considered their bigger threat. The armored Neimoidian guards, the ones who might be searching for suspicious activity. Ignore them for now, he said, and they entered a densely packed area of well-dressed travelers of all shapes and sizes. So many species eager to do business with the Trade Federation. Coming here meant paying high prices to take in the view from Cato Neimoidia's luxury hotels and spas, especially the buildings hanging downward from massive arches of their bridge cities. As long as they ignore us in return, we'll be fine. R2-D2 offered an annoyed beep at the constant starting and stopping as they waited for cross-traffic to clear up. Repulsor lifts carrying suitcases, or people simply too caught up in their own business to offer basic politeness.
The droid threw a set of curses at a female moon who bumped into him, but the tall, thin woman didn't give them a second glance.
Easy, R2, Anakin said. You never know who might actually understand you here.
So, are you going to tell me why we're here now?
Mill asked after several more steps. Anakin shot her a puzzled look.
You know why we're here. You volunteered to come along.
No, I know I'm helping you. And I know it's something about Master Kenobi. Something that's not fighting with hundreds of clones. But what?
Anakin rose onto his toes for a view toward the exit, training and angling around taller beings than humans. Except this really was just a small tactic to avoid the question. She was right, though. The youngling understood that in general, they were here to find Obi-Wan, discover who'd stolen his comlink. The nuts and bolts of that, though, remained vague, partially because he hadn't figured out exactly what to do once they landed, but partially because he wasn't sure how to explain the mystery evidence. It wasn't quite a rescue mission, and the politics of the situation mucked up the neat boundaries of what needed to happen. Could he just say that it felt right being at Obi-Wan's side when things might go sour?
It's complicated. Politics aren't things younglings should think about. I don't even like thinking about it much.
Cato Neimoidia's air was thick, the fog making it harder to breathe the instant they stepped out of the air-conditioned port building. Mill inhaled sharply and stopped in mid-step. The flow of foot traffic moved around them as if they were a rock that somehow interrupted a river, rather than two people taking in a disaster. From their vantage point several stories up, the gap in Zara was jarring. The capital city stretched over the horizon, rocky spires and other formations acting as foundational anchors between blocks and districts. Yet a massive hole was visible to the upper left, as if the Katasura district had simply evaporated from existence. Had they stood closer, the collateral damage of the explosions probably would have been visible in the remaining underlying infrastructure. But from this distance, it was simply gone. Transport circumvented the disaster area, still taking residents and visitors from one block to another. Anakin squinted, an internal judgment coming on about the people all around them. The people resuming their normal lives and taking transports to work as they floated over such devastation. Except when Mill paused, he did too, and he took in the scene around him. What he knew of the Trade Federation, of Neimoidians, had all come from the way the HoloNet portrayed them. The way Senator Lot Dodd blustered, anything and everything Newt Gunray had ever done. While the Neimoidians coming and going no longer paused at the shock of the missing Katasura district, they moved forward, some purposefully avoiding a look in that direction, others looking at it for too long. Their mourning had nothing to do with Newt Gunray's actions. For the city's residents, lives pushed forward, but the way each of them took in such a tragedy was a personal, internalized experience that Anakin could only interpret from their expressions, or lack thereof. Mill, on the other hand, wore her feelings on her face.
I think, she said, I'm getting better at this.
What's this?
Feeling this.
She gestured at the space all around.
I can sense their suffering, but it's not like I'm drowning anymore. I can handle it.
She reached over, taking Anakin's gloved hand.
Thank you. Everything you've shown me is far greater than getting a lightsaber crystal.
Maybe he should have stayed with the initiates who were impressed with lightsaber tricks and floating objects. Playing an afternoon entertainer was much easier than trying to understand this youngling. Someone who didn't quite fit the Jedi mold but was changing before his very eyes through lived experience. Seeing the way things worked outside the comforts of the Jedi Temple. Anakin took in a deep breath of Cato Neimoidia's muggy atmosphere and finally attempted to answer Mill's earlier question. Without a plan. He'd just say it. You want to know what we're doing here? Obi-Wan, my old master. He's here trying to clear the Republic. He was supposed to not contact anyone. Not the Council, not the Senate. Not me. But he needed help on something he found. Something that might incriminate the Republic. And I gave him a secret communicator for a worst-case scenario. It's just... Anakin bit down on his lip. It's now, worser than worst-case scenario.
Why is that?
Someone else has the communicator. He stepped forward, both Mill and R2-D2 shortly following. And with that, the data implicating the Republic. We've got to find Obi-Wan, find that data, find a way to explain why it seems authentic.
Do you think the Republic is free of blame?
Just like that, Anakin's good feelings evaporated, a surge of irritation. Any questioning of the Republic meant questioning him, the Jedi, Palpatine, Padme. But he stifled the feeling, stuffing it deep down before it might turn into something worse. I don't think that's possible. The Republic is trying to stop the war. The Chancellor would have known about an operation. He looked at Mill, trying his best not to be scolding. Why would you think that? You're a Jedi.
If the data seems authentic, I just think it's important to ask. Don't you?
Padme questioned words and intentions, always looking for ways of addressing what lay underneath the surface of what people presented. Obi-Wan questioned the details, always trying to get down to a true understanding of what happened. And even if he doubted the motives of individual politicians, his allegiance to the Republic never shook. Their questioning always drilled further down. But questioning the bigger picture, the thing that held them together? Anakin took a moment to contemplate such a thing. I didn't. Individuals made wrong decisions, but the institutions in their life? He wanted to say that of course they were trustworthy, that they were the foundation that everything was built upon. How trustworthy they were, though, depended on the people in them. As long as morally sound people like Padme, like Palpatine, steered those institutions, they'd be safe. Keeping those people in power, though, meant finding and confronting bad actors, especially the ones in the shadows. Not until this moment. I like to think that only good people make decisions for the Republic. I suppose it's possible. Corruption is possible. A different type of anger sparked in Anakin. What if the data was authentic? Someone working on the inside, but why? War profiteers or someone looking to betray the Chancellor? If corruption did exist somewhere within the Republic government, it had to be rooted out and eliminated. This was something he'd have to discuss with Palpatine at some point. But not now. Right now, his mission was Obi-Wan and the missing equipment. You've given me something to think about. Look at that. I'm learning something from you. We'll call it even now. Mill smiled, a welcome sight, given their location and the surrounding situation.
I thought you were supposed to be the mentor.
Me? Anakin laughed. I don't think I was put in this galaxy to teach. They made their way to the bottom of the port's entrance, the dense crowd gradually thinning out as they broke into their separate paths. Above them hung buildings from a colossal arch, a waterfall from there coming straight down into a large circular fountain in the garden in front of them. And in that water, a hologram appeared, followed by a flourish of music, the Neimoidians' own version of the HoloNet news. Not surprisingly, the bombing remained the lead story,
First, images of the smoking wreckage from the surface, then search and rescue teams working through the rubble. Then Obi-Wan with a lightsaber in an official-looking room. That's not good, Anakin said. Without turning away, he reached over and tapped R2-D2 on the dome. R2, do a sweep of the area. See if you pick up any further information about what's happening. R2-D2 let out a quick flurry of chirps. Well, not just eavesdropping. Run some scans, too. See if anything seems out of the ordinary. Two short whistles of acknowledgement came before the droid rotated and rolled away, leaving Anakin to focus on the holonet. The scenes changed quickly, the news anchor narrating over it.
The Republic's Jedi emissary, Obi-Wan Kenobi, appeared before local officials at a hearing related to the Cat Asura catastrophe. But the presentation quickly turned violent as Kenobi drew his weapon and attempted an escape.
It cut to a rooftop chase. Obi-Wan running at a normal speed despite pursuit behind him and a clear set of guards in front of him.
The Jedi used his special abilities to attack Kato Neimoidian seeker remotes before tactical guard teams apprehended him.
Things didn't add up here. Obi-Wan's lightsaber didn't appear in the later images despite it being in the first shot. And though he had patrols on either side of him, Anakin saw multiple escape routes off the terrace. To another roof, to a passing vehicle, or up a tower. Obi-Wan worked more methodically than Anakin, but those options would be obvious to any Jedi used to thinking far beyond two-dimensional escape routes. Of the guards who apprehended him, one wore specialized armor. And another person approached, a pale woman who was clearly not a guard, but the image didn't provide enough clarity for further detail. Could this be Dooku's agent?
What should we do?
Mill asked. Anakin bit down on his lip, thoughts racing while he tried to take in this sudden new set of unexpected variables. The way Obi-Wan ran still felt off, and Anakin considered the possibilities until only one felt right. He let himself be captured, possibly even hid his lightsaber securely elsewhere. That was Obi-Wan Kenobi, always negotiating until the last minute. We should find him. This might be part of his plan. Anakin turned as R2-D2 whistled, rolling back to them at full speed. But even if it is, we should let him know that we can run point for him. Let's start to... R2-D2 interrupted again, beeps and boops demanding his attention. Okay. I'm listening. What is... The droid didn't let him finish, and instead beeped out details in an insistent rhythm before projecting a local map with a red dot blinking at them.
What's that? Mill asked. Is that Obi-Wan?
No, Anakin said, kneeling down to examine the location. Something about 100 meters away, tucked between a pair of buildings in what appeared to be a commercial district, possibly restaurants. It's a bomb. They made a pair of sweeps around the bomb, Anakin and Mill using their Jedi perception to sense any individuals radiating any strong fears or disturbances. At the same time, R2-D2 rolled in a perimeter check, scanning for additional explosives. They met around the corner from the bomb, Mill waiting for the astromech to return, while Anakin inspected the explosive material and wiring. The good news? Anakin asked when they reunited. It doesn't appear to have a timer. I'm pretty sure it's remotely activated. It's a sloppy job. The wiring is loosely soldered. The formation of the explosive isn't precise. It's some kind of orange compound. I haven't seen it before, but it... R2-D2 beeped impatiently. Of course I know you can figure it out. We'll need to document the details to send to the Republic. but it shouldn't take too long to disarm. The bad news is, it's still a bomb. R2-D2's dome rotated as a headshake, then a set of beeps made Anakin's face turn into a grim frown. You're right, R2. The droid was certainly never one to dance around bad news. That is worse.
What's worse?
Mill squinted, as if that might make it easier to understand the beeps of astromech droid language. He's found two more. Anakin caught Mill's expression shifting to wide-eyed amazement, prompting a short laugh from him. Never underestimate R2. He knelt down as R2-D2 put out a projection of the suspected locations. He says that, based on their locations, they might be part of a series. An explosive chain by design. The fingers of his gloved hand rubbed his chin, the tactical decisions here refusing to easily conclude in a clear path forward. Obi-Wan needed help. His equipment needed to be found. The Republic needed to be cleared, and these bombs needed to be defused. But by when? No good answers existed. The only certainty being that the bombs existed, and that Obi-Wan would face a trial of some sort tomorrow. Obi-Wan says one of my biggest problems is I don't know when to ask for help, Anakin finally said, looking over at Mill. This might be a time to ask for help.
You mean, contact the Republic?
Yeah. They could send a battalion out here in time for the trial. If we locate all the bombs and transmit their locations, they can nullify them and rescue Obi-Wan in one fell swoop. Anakin's lips pursed at the next thought. I hate making Master Windu write, though. R2-D2 chimed several tones, an affirmative that clearly stated his opinion. It's the fastest way to do it. You think you can get a clear signal?
But wait, Mill said. We can't do that.
Because it would make Master Windu right? The joke went over Mill's head, barely breaking the cadence of her words.
If the evidence already looks like the Republic did the bombing, sending in clones will only make it worse, even if their goal is to help.
The image of Republic gunships swooping through Cato Ne Moria's bridge cities came to Anakin's mind. Clones offloading in rapid, precise succession across both governmental docking ports and civilian facilities. You're right. They would see it as an invasion, and possibly turn to the Separatists for help.
And they might execute Master Kenobi.
Anakin nodded. And they might execute Obi-Wan, he said grimly. This was not going to be like Geonosis. No swarm of Jedi would come in to tip the scales in battle. No endless waves of clones would fly in to wipe out the opposition. This mission, in whatever form it had now taken, and however unofficial it was, relied on Anakin's decisions alone. And it started with his promise to Obi-Wan, a promise that could be bent, but not broken. Because it came with the respect of Obi-Wan's understanding of the situation on Cato Ne Moria. His entire goal was to steer the war toward peaceful negotiations. That had to be why he let himself get captured. But getting to Obi-Wan was simply unfeasible if they had to spend the next day locating and defusing bombs. This was a choice. One that carried all of the weight and responsibility of being a Jedi Knight. Slow, even breaths coursed through Anakin as he closed his eyes and weighed the different outcomes here. Find Obi-Wan and risk the bombs? Or find the bombs and risk Obi-Wan? What Anakin had told Mill earlier, what his mother had told him years ago about the Sun Dragon and trusting your heart, the problem was that Anakin cared deeply about both things, and he could only pick one. A different Obi-Wan memory came to the forefront of his mind, as if the Force nudged it into his consciousness as a bit of right place, right time recollection.
What do you think Padme would do if she were in your position? He'd yelled as they soared over the endless Geonosian dunes. Anakin remembered what he said. Not just the words, but the way the feelings processed through him, the wind stinging against his face, the smell of burning fuel and fired rockets all around them. The connections between Anakin and Obi-Wan, between Anakin and Padme, they were both his reason and his guide in their own ways. Padme would do her duty, and here Anakin would do his, while putting his faith in Obi-Wan to do what he needed to do. With a backup plan in his own way, of course. He was, after all, still Anakin Skywalker. His heart would never change, no matter how much his wife and his former master tried to temper his impulses. He stared down this impossible situation, the tug in two different directions, and he made a silent vow that he simply would find a way. R2, he said, we're going to take care of the bombs. Try to locate the others. We've got less than a day.
What about Obi-Wan?
Mill asked. We'll work as fast as we can. And if we succeed, we'll still have time to get to Obi-Wan. If not... Anakin stood up, his mind and body already coiled and ready to spring into action. We'll be there for him when he needs us most.
Chapter 37. Obi-Wan Kenobi. Several hours into Obi-Wan's meditation, a noise brought him back into the moment. A beep, then some mechanical grinding, followed by a heavy clank that echoed throughout the cell. He remained seated on the floor until the door began to slide open, the light from the outside casting a silhouette. The figure met all standard Neimoidian proportions, but carried itself with a different posture from the usual Neimoidian guards. This one had the weight of experience on its shoulders. It was Roog, holding up some sort of device. She looked up, then over each shoulder, then clicked the device. It fired off two quick beeps before she stepped inside, the door shutting behind her. A single finger went to her mouth. Obi-Wan took the hint and refrained from saying anything until she indicated otherwise. A thin orange beam projected from the device, expanding out in all directions to scan the floor before hitting the bottom corners and moving upward. It crawled up the walls and made it to the ceiling, where all four sides approached a center point, collapsing the beam until it became a single dot that vanished.
There, Roog said, pocketing the device. Temporarily disables the surveillance.
Are you here to break me out?
Obi-Wan asked, standing to meet Roog face to face.
I don't know. Depends on what we figure out.
She sighed, then looked around the cell.
We don't have a lot of time.
Where is your young friend?
Keeta, I'm sorry he keeps shooting at you.
Roog laughed, which made Obi-Wan laugh.
He's young and impulsive, but his patriotic intentions are true. I just wish he slowed down before pulling any triggers.
Obi-Wan didn't try hiding his smile at that.
I've said that before.
Too many times.
They're a handful, right? But it's the only way they'll learn.
Obi-Wan said with a nod, before taking this into a more serious direction.
I suggest keeping him away from Asajj Ventress.
Roog's eyes narrowed, a clear shift in her shoulders and posture at the mention of Ventress.
I've tried, but I know she's found him. Or maybe he's found her. There's something off about her. She arrived under the guise of a diplomatic overseer, but everything she says has a clear purpose, one that I don't agree with.
I don't trust her.
Well, I could say the same about you.
Roog's words stung, but Obi-Wan knew he deserved it.
It's just you and me here. No Seekers, no Keitar, no Ventress. So I want honesty, and I want it now. Why didn't you tell me about the datapad?
It's what I said before. I needed to know if it was authentic or not.
Then tell me you had a lead.
Let me ask you this. If the datapad pointed at the Separatists, would you have kept it from me?
That is a hypothetical.
Vastu! Don't give me that. Your own personal biases kept that information from me. And here's the thing, the really absurd thing that could have saved us a whole lot of headaches, maybe even prevented you from being in this prison cell right now.
What's that?
I told you I had a lead and I needed a few days, which was exactly what you should have said to me. Well, I got my confirmation from my sources, and my lead points to the Separatists.
Rug took out a datapad from her back pocket and tossed it at him. Obi-Wan caught it and began scrolling through its screen. The information sat neatly organized, formatted section by section in a table. The explosive patterns and incendiary traces exactly matched the Separatist blazer bombs seen in the field, only scaled down into a personal scale. The clamping brackets, the mounting tools, even the bomb placement all matched exact specifications used by Separatist droids. It was as detailed as the report he'd recovered on the surface, if not more so.
You're certain this is authentic?
Absolutely. I'd bet my life on it.
You're betting mine on it, Obi-Wan said, handing it back to her.
That too.
A wave of emotions flooded through Obi-Wan, a sense of relief and a depressurizing calm that dissipated the anxiety of the last few days. Despite all his training and abilities, something of this magnitude still weighed on him more than he wanted to recognize, let alone admit, given the sudden change he felt.
So the Republic didn't do it, he said, as if stating it made it all more real.
But one thing doesn't make sense. That transmission from my
There it was. He almost said it again. My partner.
It had confirmed the authenticity of the materials. Granted, with the context still a mystery. But my source, I trust him with vetting these types of things. It's unlike him to be this wrong on this type of scope.
Rug looked at him, her head tilted as if she stared right through him. Her large eyes didn't blink, didn't even move until several seconds passed and her expression dropped.
You don't get it, do you?
Apparently not. What am I missing here?
Rug huffed out a sigh, then began a slow pace around the room.
You're thinking like a Jedi. Within the rules of how the Republic operates, or how you think the Republic operates.
What is that supposed to mean?
There's the way governments work for the people, and the way they work for themselves. I told you, people like me shape the truth. I have done missions without any authorizations from heads of state. I've murdered people by making it look like a complete accident. These things happen. This galaxy is a brutal, cold place with no logic or compassion. I've seen it, she said, thumb tapping against her armored chest. And once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Though she didn't explicitly say, Rug's words opened up a new path of thinking, an ugly underbelly of possibility that existed outside the realm of Jedi dogma and Republic law. Obi-Wan took in a short inhale, one that nearly knocked him off balance.
The data. Now you're starting to understand,
Rug said, her voice dry, almost apologetic.
You're absolutely certain about your findings. Like you, I used someone I trust. I tracked what I could against archives from the governmental data center. It's ironic, looking up this information, she said with a headshake. The biggest makeshift infirmary is right next to the data center where all the bombing information is stored.
She pulled out the small device she used to disable surveillance and checked it.
This is about to go down a deep hole with no clear answers. So we need to be honest with each other from here on out. Agree?
Agree? We may be the only two people in this operating on good faith.
Which means every side is relying on us to get this right. Whether they know it or not.
Whether they like it or not. Obi-Wan said, his voice steady.
That's right.
Rogue shook her head, eyes dimming into a grim expression.
No more seeing it as Republic versus Separatist. That's too simple, too binary. Evidence points to each side, which leaves only one possibility. Someone is playing both sides in secret.
Everything Obi-Wan had hoped to achieve with his investigation, from the moment he spoke with Count Dooku among the Jedi Council, suddenly changed. Like a hollow recorder quickly rotating on its subject to reveal a completely different image. His mind began churning, the way ideas spun off further ideas for an endless chain of possibilities.
Who would want to escalate on both sides?
Rogue asked, practically reading Obi-Wan's mind.
Who benefits from that? Mutually assured destruction helps no one, not even the lawless. They need a framework to exploit.
It would not be the Trade Federation. Obi-Wan thought of Satine, her speech on neutrality urging a policy of non-intervention to maintain peace on Mandalore. Nor a neutral system. The longer this goes on, the more it inhibits anyone's ability to deal from a neutral stance.
This was a systemic strike. Not something that could be done by a rogue agent. Or even something like the Bounty Hunters Guild. You've seen the blast points, the damage analysis. It's too precise. I've worked with bounty hunters,
Rogue said with a chuckle.
And precise is not part of their standard operating procedure. So the question is, did they emulate Republic and Separatist protocols? Or were both engaged in secret ops unknowingly commissioned by the same party?
Obi-Wan reached out into the currents of the Force, sinking into it to let it carry him somewhere. But it didn't. The normal sense of flow that came with connecting to the Force felt dissonant here, interrupted, chaotic, blocked. An unexpected fight required to get through the thick cloak draped over it. The dark side. Since the war erupted, the Jedi had been sent all over the galaxy, a mix of fighting separatist forces while playing diplomat to rally local systems to maintain their loyalty to the Republic. But every now and then, when Obi-Wan had a quiet moment, he found himself drawn back to a different moment on Geonosis. Not the battle that spiraled out of control, endless clones and droids and Jedi massacring one another, but a quiet moment beforehand. The only face-to-face exchange he ever had with Dooku, Count of Sereno, and leader of the Separatist forces. He'd spewed lies, a blatant attempt to draw Obi-Wan in, even daring to invoke the name of Qui-Gon Jinn. But somewhere in that obfuscation, one statement held true. Something Obi-Wan felt certain in his bones. The dark side of the Force has clouded their vision, he'd said. The dark side, yes. But a single Sith Lord holding such sway without any hint detected by the Jedi? Impossible. The Jedi were nearly 10,000 strong, an interconnected web of beings in tune with the Force, and such a disturbance to the flow of life would be obvious. No, these machinations must be something else. A symptom of the dark side, but surely not its epicenter. Obi-Wan focused on that while Rogue checked her device again. Perhaps the culprit is not important. He finally said, his mind working to take steps ahead of whatever nudged the galaxy into further conflict. Perhaps what is important is that both sides see how they are being weaponized against each other. And with that awareness, the urgency to find common ground will be ever greater.
Her device beeped, its tip changing from orange to a blinking red.
We are running out of time before surveillance resumes. Do you believe the best chance for peace is for you to bring this information back to the Republic right now? Are you offering to help me escape? If that's in the best interests of my people, then yes.
Obi-Wan hesitated, stroking his beard in contemplation.
What will happen if you are caught assisting me?
Best case?
Rook's laugh said more than enough.
They arrest me for treason. Worst case, well, I suppose I wouldn't be alive long enough to know what they'd specifically do.
I understand, he said, watching the blinking red light on her device. Do you still believe in the ideals that drive your government?
You can always believe in the cause, she said, even if you don't agree with the leadership.
The device's light accelerated its beeping, and she moved to the door, sliding it open enough to peek outside.
You must choose.
The paths before Obi-Wan came with no easy answers. If Anakin had been here, they could have collaborated, somehow involving one of his daring escapes to sneakily inform the Republic while Obi-Wan used his trial as his only chance of public explanation, possibly negotiation. But that wasn't the case here. He was a lone emissary of the Republic, and his goal was peace. Escaping now would cast the Republic in an even worse light. And though the odds appeared slim for any diplomacy to sway Cadan Amordian officials, they still came with a very harsh, but hopeful, truth. Slim was better than none.
I will remain here for now.
You're sure?
She stepped out, fingers gripping the door.
The path out is clear. Surveillance will resume soon. We must go now if you're leaving.
Obi-Wan shook his head.
I hope you'll be there tomorrow, he said, in case I need some help.
His hand waved at the door, the force nudging it closed. All around him, subtle clicking noises ticked through the room. The sound of audio and video surveillance reactivating. Rook's muffled voice came through the thick walls like a casual greeting to a passing guard. Though the floor was cold and uncomfortable, Obi-Wan resumed his position for deep meditation, seated, legs crossed, mind and body open to the Force.
Chapter 38 Anakin Skywalker.
7 total bombs. It took all day and then some, but R2-D2 felt reasonably confident that he had identified all of the bombs and their locations. While Anakin and Mills set out to defuse the first one, R2-D2 examined the locations of the next two. A simple extrapolation using the droid's computational skills, combined with, Anakin admitted, R2-D2's strong instincts for being right, built out options for 5, 7, or 9 bombs, all attached to landmarks of local significance. An elaborate statue that reached up and touched the floor of a transparent steel restaurant hanging down from an overhead arch. A building that by official standards was the oldest in Zara. An immaculately constructed tower adjacent to the large official courtyard of Obi-Wan's trial. And others along those lines. Each seemed to be something that might have caught a simple glance from a traveler, but carried more meaning to local residents. And for someone from the Republic, they represented a crash course in cultural legacy and history. Details that the Jedi archives somehow overlooked. The bombs surrounded the government offices, and R2-D2 projected a map, lines crossing to make the target quite clear that these explosions were designed as a message. Because at the center of it all lay the courtyard where Obi-Wan would be on trial, the so-called Grand Theater of Judgment. And all of the targets themselves stood within viewing distance. In fact, the tall tower loomed over the large square, which promised a public hollow viewing of the trial. Whoever the terrorist was, all of this played out as some sort of twisted representation of the Republic. Were the bombs intended to go off before Obi-Wan's trial, to push his verdict straight to guilty? During the trial, to frame his statements in destructive chaos? After his trial, as punishment of some sort for whatever way the verdict broke? Every option seemed possible. And these were things Anakin often left to Obi-Wan to figure out. Anakin was more of the impossible deeds with a lightsaber at high altitudes and long jumps type of Jedi Knight. But Obi-Wan's thoughtful analysis and strategic mind would have put this puzzle together. Something else was at play here, though who they were and what their exact purpose was, he still wondered. R2-D2's analysis remained on the purely technical side, the explosive capabilities of the bombs, the type of compound used, the range of the detonator sensor. But that didn't necessarily dive into criminal psychology. And while Mill gained more control over her abilities with each passing moment, her unique sensory vision didn't help with this task. Though, as Anakin noted with a little bit of pride, she picked up the technical bits of bomb disarmament fast, despite having a completely different upbringing from Anakin's own early days fixing things in Watto's junkyard. By the time they finished the seventh bomb and scouted a tiring radius all around the governmental district, the droid claimed with 93% probability that they'd covered all the possibilities. Percentages were usually the realm of C-3PO, and Anakin assumed R2-D2 rounded the numbers as he sat with an exhausted Mill, day having turned into night. With the chrono ticking until crowds would gather for Obi-Wan's trial, Anakin had to decide between trying to get to Obi-Wan now or indulging in what little rest they could. But practicality won out. They might not find Obi-Wan in time, and if that was the case, they'd have to help him at the trial, which meant they needed to be ready. After moving the ship from the public port to a less conspicuous warehouse district on the outskirts, they found a spot underneath a bridge in a quiet sector halfway to the governmental district, a place where commerce blended with residential housing. They sat against stone, R2-D2 keeping watch. Mill slept, leaning against Anakin, her thin black ponytail draped over his shoulder. Exhaustion took her over. And even if Anakin wanted to keep pushing forward, she would have passed out, having nudged her body to the limit. As for Anakin, he wanted to keep one eye open the entire time, but R2-D2 nagged him to rest, beeping messages about how his timing and strength would be off if he was too exhausted to fight or run. While the astromech droid kept a running scan on their surroundings, Anakin closed his eyes, and though he tried to get into a restful meditation, something deeper and more regenerative than sleep, his mind kept turning back to the mystery of the bombs. Not so much who planted them, but why were they all connected? And what was the meaning behind each target? No answers arrived during Anakin's rest, though the mental space allowed his spirit to recharge a little bit. Mill, though, still seemed to fight with exhaustion, and perhaps the emotional whiplash of going from a simple training assignment to Fate of the Republic tasks wore on her more than she wanted to admit. By the time they'd gathered their bearings and emerged from their hiding spot, the population of Zara walked with purpose to the main square. If Anakin hadn't known differently, the scene would have felt more akin to a local festival or holiday celebration. The only shift came from the attitude of the attendees. While something more joyous would have laughter and singing, the citizens moving past Anakin, Mill, and R2-D2 carried a collective weight on their shoulders,
many wearing frowns or looking at the ground, and most draped in deep blue clothes, which Anakin took to be a mourning custom. Though Anakin didn't speak Pak-Pak, the tone of the conversations conveyed enough. Anger, blame, regret, longing. All of those things came through simply from the volume and rhythm of the words between people. Some of the city's non-Neimoidian residents did express their sentiments in basic, and they didn't hide their thoughts about what they wanted. And if Anakin wasn't sure, Mill's expression reflected their mood, her empathic abilities chipping away at her already exhausted body. "Stay strong," he said to her as they walked. She looked up and nodded, and he hoped a reassuring smile might buoy her sagging spirits. The physical toll of all this colliding with the emotional wave from the emerging crowd. Her ability to control her connection with the Force had grown significantly, and what would have once crippled her now moved in step with her, an extension of her abilities rather than a hindrance. Sink or swim, he thought, and Mills swam stronger than he would have ever hoped given the way their first encounter went. Even though the trial centered on Obi-Wan, and by extension the Republic, it became clear that it didn't matter who was involved. This community had sustained a deep and irreparable wound. Grief and trauma were on trial, and the people wanted justice in whatever form they could take it. Their mourning demanded it.
"I can feel it, like walking through a stream."
Mill took steady steps and her eyes focused ahead, the nausea that aided her before seemingly transformed.
"Not just what they're feeling, but how they're feeling it. They have lost friends, family, partners, children."
She looked up at Anakin, a ray of sun lighting her brown eyes.
"This comes outside of the war. Their pain is no different from that of the people on Langston. They don't deserve this."
"That can't be our concern right now." Anakin paused, wondering if that sounded heartless. It wasn't meant to. Padme would have cared about the civilians the same way. But all of that had to be tempered with the mission. "What I mean is, we have a duty to do right by the Republic. To the Chancellor. To Obi-Wan."
"What about them?"
Mill asked. For the first time, a rise came to her voice.
"What do they deserve?"
"They deserve the truth. And if anyone can find the truth, it's Obi-Wan." Anakin stopped and surveyed the scene. The 7 bomb locations were all visible, all forming a perimeter around the central location of the trial. He paused, and though urges pulled at him to just get on with it, to ignore whatever complaints Mill had, something pushed back, settling him down easier than whenever he butted heads with Obi-Wan.
"Hear them. Each of these people. They may not matter to governments when the galaxy is at war, but they should matter to us."
Anakin nodded, closing his eyes to listen. He didn't use the Force, didn't attempt anything akin to Mill's abilities. He simply took in what he'd heard. The voices and emotions coming out from generations of mourning all pulling toward the town square. Mill was right. Regardless of what happened in conference rooms and political centers across countless star systems, the individuals who suffered the consequences were often overlooked, ignored. And though some of them cursed at Obi-Wan, at the Republic, Anakin reminded himself that those words simply funneled their pain into something tangible. Obi-Wan's job would be to redirect that with the truth. And Anakin's job would be to help him. For the Republic and these people. Chapter 39. Mill Alabeth. The proceedings played out on a giant holographic display, like a sporting event rather than a war trial. Mill steadied herself, every roar and surge of emotion swaying her.
That's Senator Lot Dodd,
Anakin said as a holographic Nemoidian in fancy robes took up the space and began speaking. Mill's lips twisted in confusion, prompting Anakin to continue.
He represents the Trade Federation in galactic politics. They've committed to remaining neutral in the war, have disavowed Newt Gunray. Cato Nemoidia is the center of their operations, but here he's promised to stay out of any investigation.
Dodd's brief, calm talk did little to soothe the crowd, though.
I am abiding by the commitment I have previously made,
he said, the crowd continuing to chatter over his projected voice.
My presence is as an observer. I am in orbit above Cato Nemoidia with fellow Trade Federation officials. We leave this in the capable hands of those with the best perspective. The leaders of Cato Nemoidia itself.
Mild applause rippled through the square, and Mill looked up at the person who'd become a mentor to her over the last few days. He stood, his jaw tight beneath an unblinking stare. And though Mill was capable of picking up emotions from everyone around her, Anakin Skywalker remained a mystery. Not because his emotions were hidden. No, it was that they were all there, each one fighting to be seen and heard, like every color thrown on top of one another to blur themselves all out.
Bring out the prisoner,
a voice said over loudspeakers, and the hologram switched from Senator Dodd to a live view of the courtyard setting, the whole thing floating above the spectators in the square. A judge oversaw the proceedings, an older female Nemoidian in ceremonial robes and headdress, wearing a silver-lined sash that probably indicated her official rank. Obi-Wan Kenobi came out in shackles, walking with a steady pace and a calm look on his face, even though guards pushed them forward with the butts of their rifles.
This is where we have to split up, Anakin said.
He knelt down and looked Mill straight in the eye. There it was again, that whirlwind of emotions that seemed to both orbit and permeate Anakin, unlike any other Jedi she'd ever encountered. Perhaps unlike any other being in existence. What lay beyond that, at the eye of the storm? The past few days had exposed her to so many different types of people in such a range of circumstances that her unique ability evolved into instinct. She found herself being able to filter the waves of emotions and reset herself like a muscle. It grew stronger and more controlled, rapidly becoming something that connected her with the Force without overwhelming her senses. Except with Anakin.
Listen, he said, stick to the plan.
Know what to look for. We'll rendezvous when the time is right, and trust in the Force. But more important, he nodded, as if he were saying this to himself, trust in yourself.
Understood, Master.
I'll see you soon, youngling. With that, Anakin moved swiftly like he rode a wave that carried him through the crowd of people. Several seconds later, and Mill couldn't have found Anakin if she tried. She pulled her dirty, torn hood over her head and set out in the opposite direction, doing exactly what he'd instructed. Look for a way out. Voices broadcast overhead. Official declarations that reviewed the recent days, from Obi-Wan's arrival to the events that Mill watched as a holographic replay. The confrontation in the Cato Nemoidian office, the chase along the terrace and parapet, his eventual capture. But she ignored the details, not needing them, and instead focused on the things Anakin emphasized to her. First, there needed to be a path that provided solid cover and easy stealth with the ability to switch things up should they need to lose guards. Second, as few obstacles as possible, which Mill took as find a stretch with the fewest guards. She searched
using the Force to provide a deeper perspective to her space in the ways that so many in the temple had taught her over the years. And the more she sank into the Force, combining her natural abilities and reading what the Force told her, the more she felt like each step forward increased her capabilities and her understanding of herself. She was glad that she'd skipped the gathering. A lightsaber didn't find the way, not in a situation like this. The broadcast continued, a lengthy speech going step by step over the rooftop chase, and Mill moved as fast as she could, only to hit a wall of emotions that stopped her in her tracks. The massive wave of pain all came from the south side, and as she closed her eyes to let the Force color in her true vision, she saw it. Not the damage of the people watching the trial, but injured Nemoidians and others lying down in a huge makeshift infirmary. The voices of the trial faded away as Mill gave in to the vision, the burning red silhouettes of each and every person filling up her mind's eye until she finally forced herself to return to the here and now. She opened her eyes and found herself some 10 meters from the infirmary, a white tent draped over a shoddy frame, as if the Force had unconsciously pulled her there. One breath, then two, then a third went in and out, a calming technique that reconnected her mind and body, and she noticed a detail that might just save herself, Anakin, and Obi-Wan.